From PRI, Public Radio International.
So, here you are. The little number they've tucked away for Brother Nelly, he said. I'm not tucked away for anyone. No, on second thought, you wouldn't be. Girls like you play for higher stakes. Love or income, or preferably both.
You're listening to Maya Dillon reading an old-fashioned story by Laurie Colwyn, one of the love stories on today's Valentine season edition of Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Love plays an important part in so many stories that become part of Selected Shorts throughout the year. But around Valentine's Day, we are sentimental enough, even in this age of being cool above all, to try to bring a little romance into the lives of our listeners. So settle down now with your nice hot cup of cocoa or your significant other to hear two stories from our evening at Symphony Space entitled Falling in Love. Alice Hoffman, host of the program, introduces the first of her picks, Laurie Colwyn's An Old-Fashioned Story, which is then read by Maya Dillon.
And looking for stories about real love, I discovered that most authors do not write about happy love affairs. I discovered that writers write about betrayal, lust, divorce, the wrong man, the wrong woman, divorce, women who can't be trusted, men who aren't dependable, divorce, unhappy love in the suburbs or the city, women who throw themselves in front of trains, women who lock themselves away on the day of their wedding. I've come to realize that when writers are in love, they don't write. They do other things because they're in love. They're busy. And it's when they fall out of love that they write. It's when they're searching for love that they write. It's when they're done with love that they write. But as we know, there are still stories that celebrate love. There are stories that remind us why we fall in love in the first place, often when we least expect it. Laurie Colwyn is a writer who created an elegant fictional world during her lifetime. And tonight, her story is the perfect New York love story. Despite having gone to the best schools and having lived at the best addresses, these characters are just as stupid as we are when it comes to love. And now, here's Maya Dillon to read an old-fashioned story.
The Rodkers had a son named Nelson, whom all the world called Nelly. The Leopolds had a daughter named Elizabeth. Marshall Rodker and Roger Leopold had been at college and law school together and courted wives who had been roommates at college. Nelson was 2 years Elizabeth's senior, and he was a model child in every way. Elizabeth, on the other hand, began her life as a rebellious, spunky, and passionate child. But she was extraordinarily pretty, and such children are never called difficult. They are called original. It was the ardent hope of these people that their children might be friends, and when they grew up, would like each other well enough to marry. In order to ensure their happy future, the children were brought together. If Elizabeth looked about to misbehave, Eleanor Leopold placed her warm hand on Elizabeth's forearm, and with a little squeeze Elizabeth learned to dread, would say in tones of determined sweetness, "Darling, don't you want to see nice Nellie's chemistry set?" Elizabeth did not want to see it, or Nelson's stamp collection, or his perfect math papers, or the model city he had built with his erector set. As she grew older, she did not want to dance with Nelson at dancing class or go to his school reception. But she did these things. That warm pressure on her forearm was as effective as a slap, although her compliance was not gained only by squeezes and horrified looks. Elizabeth had begun to have a secret life. She hated Nelson, and she hated the Rodkers with secret fury. While she was too young to wonder if this loathing included her parents, she felt that if they forced Nelson upon her and chose the Rodkers for their dearest friends, they must in some way be against her. At the same time, she realized that they were foolable to an amazing extent. If she smiled at Nelson, they were happy and considered her behavior impeccable. If she was rude, she spent weeks in pain, the pain of constant lectures. Thus, she learned to turn a cheerful face while keeping the fires of her dislike properly banked. The fact of the matter was that an afternoon of Nelson's stamp collection was good for two afternoons hanging around the park with her real friends. Elizabeth's friends came down with measles, chickenpox, and mumps. But Elizabeth considered Nelson her childhood disease. As she got older, she began to feel that he had ruined her early years. But in her 20s, she realized what an asset he had been. Without him, she would never have learned to shield herself entirely from her parents. She learned from him how little it took to please. Nelson wrapped himself up warm when it was cold. He baked cookies for his mother's birthday. He played chess with his father. That, it appeared, sufficed. A very instructive lesson that was not lost on Elizabeth, who felt that beneath Nelson's clean, wavy hair lived a rat. A suck-up. A traitor to all children. Nelson had an older brother named James. James was 8 years Elizabeth's senior, and she regarded him as veritably ancient. James had been sent away to a progressive school for the brilliant and unmanageable children of the well-to-do. Here, he learned to smoke, drive a car without a license, and play cards for money. When these traits became manifest, James was plucked from the libertine environment and sent to one of this nation's oldest and finest establishments for one last crack at making him an eventual leader of men. In this setting, he drank beer, set off cherry bombs in trash cans, and hung around with town girls. By the time he was ready to graduate, he added to this sort of hell-raising a penchant for seditious literature and came home spouting Marx, Mao, and Huysmans. At college, he learned a great many more bad habits, including how to spend money, drink wine, seduce young women, and break some bone or other right before Thanksgiving vacation called him back to his family. In spite of this, he did extremely well and graduated with honors. The night of his graduation, he was arrested with some of his unwholesome friends for disorderly conduct and was made to spend the night in jail. This was meant to scare him. The next morning, he was released, his fingerprints in a manila envelope, that he might know the kindness doled out by the police to young men who will someday be their elected leaders. Elizabeth was kept abreast of James's evil career by her parents, who said that James was killing Marshall and breaking poor Harriet's heart. Nelson spoke of his brother as if he were some pathetic sort of animal. Over a game of Scrabble, which, of course, Nelson was winning, he commented on the arrest. Poor Daddy and Mother. Jimmy got arrested, you know. They gave him back his fingerprints, but it will always be on his conscience. And if he's ever asked if he's been arrested, he'll have to say yes. Why, Willie? Elizabeth said. Because it's true, said Nelson. Besides, it's adolescent and silly. It's just as easy not to get arrested as to get arrested. Nelson at the time was almost 16. He was a nice-looking, somewhat expressionless boy whom Elizabeth found more and more repulsive. All his clothes were clean. His hair was combed. Elizabeth knew that he underlined passages in books, a habit she found disgusting. When he read, he sat upright in his leather chair, under proper light, with his book held at a proper angle. Elizabeth, who read under the covers with a flashlight, found his posture disgusting as well. After a brief contemplation of the Scrabble board, Nelson made an ingenious play using the word V-U-G-H, about which Elizabeth was doubtful but did not challenge. It was pointless to challenge Nelson. He was all-knowing, and he never cheated. In fact, one of Harriet Rodker's favorite stories about him concerned a point of honor. Nelson, at 7, told his father that he had stolen 2 gum erasers from Mrs. Williamson's candy store. His father advised him to take them back. "But I can't," Nelson had said. "I was so upset about stealing them that I threw them away." Marshall Rodker then asked his son how he intended to make reparation. If, of course, was never an issue. Nelson had said, "I'll go to Mrs. Williamson and tell her what I did and pay her." This he did, and Mrs. Williamson swore she never knew a better boy than Nelson Rodker. Elizabeth was sure this was a true story, but for one detail. She was certain that Nelson had not thrown the erasers away. She knew that he had eaten them. She was convinced that when his parents were out, he made mashed potatoes from the joy of cooking so that he could eat them with his hands. Nelson and Elizabeth went to brother and sister schools, where Nelson distinguished himself. He won the Latin Prize, the Good Citizens Award, the Math Medal, and Scholar of the Year. Meanwhile, James Rodker had dropped out of what little sight he permitted his parents by going to England, where it was thought he was studying economics or history. Only the Leopolds knew how scanty information was about James. At dinner parties, his name and the subject of economic history were twined. But during Rodker-Leopold bridge games, all was revealed. As Elizabeth stood with her ear to the library door, she learned that whenever the Rodkers went to London to see him, they found that he had just gone abroad. Or if he was in town, he turned up with Hindu or Oriental girls who were clearly his mistresses. Elizabeth longed for these bridge parties. James's career filled her with admiration. With Nelson constantly held over her head, it was hard for her not to have outright affection for anyone who behaved like a punk. The beautiful daughters of the nervous well-to-do are tented like orchids, especially in a city like New York. Elizabeth was not allowed to take a public bus unaccompanied until she was 13. Her friends were carefully picked over. The little O'Connor girl was common. That her father had won a Pulitzer Prize was of no matter. The little Jefferson boy was colored. It made no difference that his father was a diplomat, and so on. The only one of Elizabeth's friends Mrs. Leopold approved of was Holly Lucas, whose mother was an old friend. Holly was the only one to be dignified by a first name. Thus, Elizabeth never brought her real friends home, since, with the exception of Holly, they were all wrong. The children of broken homes, the sons and daughters of people with odd political or religious preferences, or of blacklisted movie producers. Elizabeth learned the hard way that these children would not be made comfortable in her house. This might have put a crimp in Elizabeth's social life, except that none of her friends wanted to entertain at home. They knew early on that the best place to conduct a private life was in public. And then there was the Fifield Writing Academy incident. Like most girls her age, Elizabeth became horse crazy. She did not want to share this passion with her parents, who felt riding once a week was quite enough. So she made a deal with the stable that in exchange for a free lesson, she would muck out the stalls on Tuesdays. This, however, was not known by her mother, who had her expensively outfitted. These riding clothes Elizabeth carried in a rucksack along with her real riding clothes, an old pair of blue jeans and a ratty sweater. It was soon discovered that Elizabeth was coming home late, one extra afternoon each week, stinking of horse. She was made to remove her jodhpurs at the service entrance, and when these garments were found to be relatively horseless, a search was made, and the offending blue jeans rooted out. Mrs. Leopold then sat down to question her daughter. Elizabeth was mute. One word about manure, and her riding days were over. But manure was not on Mrs. Leopold's mind. And in fact, when she learned that her spotless baby spent one weekday in the company of a pitchfork, she was much relieved. She said, "Who works at the stable?" Elizabeth said, "You know, Mr. Fifield, that girl Franny Hatch, and some boys." "What boys?" "Oh, you know, Douglas Fifield and Buddy, the one who takes the little kids around the ring." The questioning continued until Mrs. Leopold finally asked what she was really after. "Did this Douglas or this Buddy ever try to touch you?" Elizabeth was 14 at the time, and it was clear that boys were not what worried Mrs. Leopold. It was Elizabeth herself. What wanton impulse would lead a girl to spend her time working in a stable? Besides, parents of the time believed in companionship with their children. When Elizabeth discovered bird walking or skating, stationery embossed with birds or skates was ordered in case she wished to write to her relatives. This invasion of privacy, which radical students would later call co-option, looked harmless and well-meant and was practiced by most parents. When Elizabeth went to college, she had her first taste of freedom. While similarly restrained girls went wild, Elizabeth reveled in being left alone and staying up late at night reading anything she liked. The Leopolds were not against reading, but Elizabeth's reading habits contributed to eye strain and bad posture. And besides, all that reading made one lopsided. One must also sail, dress well, speak a foreign language, and be good at tennis. Since Elizabeth had never had the luxury to read undisturbed in her own house, she had little time at college to drink to excess or become promiscuous. At home on holidays, she was correctness itself. At 20, in the middle of her first love affair, she was grown up enough to restrain herself from calling her beloved in Vermont, lest her parents find him on the telephone bill. Elizabeth's parents set great store on adult behavior. Had they known what sort of adult Elizabeth had become, great would have been their dismay. Elizabeth smiled beautifully and behaved in a flawless manner. Her mother was not entirely happy. She felt, as mothers will, that her daughter was not telling her the sort of things a daughter ought. She was vexed that Elizabeth was far away and none of her college chums could be conned. Mrs. Leopold knew she would have to wait for something to break. Elizabeth would want to go abroad to study or to go to Africa, or she would turn up engaged to an awful boy. But Elizabeth did none of these things. She was graduated from college, came back to New York, and got a job. Her decision to live in New York was not easily come by, but she loved New York, and she wanted to enjoy it finally on her own terms. She went to her father's bank, and using as collateral a diamond and sapphire bracelet left to her by her grandmother, she borrowed enough money to rent an apartment on a little street in Greenwich Village and live until she had a salary. Through a friend of the O'Connor girls' Pulitzer Prize-winning father, she found a job at a publishing company and went to work. Her parents were puzzled by this. The daughters of their friends were announcing their engagements in the Times, and those who joined the Peace Corps or had gone to graduate school were filed under the heading of useful service, as if they had entered convents or dedicated themselves to the poor, following the example of Jane Addams, who had, after all, come from a nice, rich family. Elizabeth further puzzled them by refusing to take a cent of their money, although Mrs. Leopold knew the truth. What you dole out to the young binds them to you. To have Elizabeth owing nothing was disconcerting, to say the least. To even up the side, she called Elizabeth to see if she was comfortable in her little cramped apartment that doubtless had insufficient heat. In the summer, she was sure Elizabeth was suffocating and offered an air conditioner. She worried that the cleaners in that part of town did shoddy work and brooded to Elizabeth about what young girls had for dinner. Elizabeth was in a state of bliss. She could flop down on her bed with no lecture notes or required texts and read. Her friends, who had discovered many dangerous and exotic ways in which to cherish their freedom, found Elizabeth a little pathetic in this respect. But having the power to read what she liked was the ultimate liberty. Staying up all night exhausted her. Drink made her dizzy. Drugs either disoriented her or made her sick. And she did not have a promiscuous nature. She did, however, have a lover. The lover was her next-door neighbor, Roy Wayne Howard, a large man with an Edwardian mustache. Roy was from Central Ohio, and he was a fundraiser for the Center for Union Democracy. To this end, he tried to hustle money. He found lawyers willing to donate their services. He had once been a hooded witness at the trial of some goons who had threatened an insurgent rank and file. Elizabeth, who was crazy about him, found him heroic. Elizabeth had run into Roy in the neighborhood. They introduced themselves at the all-night grocery store. One evening, Roy appeared at her door with a bottle of whiskey and two glasses. He drank most of the whiskey while he and Elizabeth sniped at one another. After several evenings of this sort, plus several afternoons watching football games on television and a meal at a crummy Spanish restaurant, they became lovers. And from then on, they were on and off. When they were on, they went to prize fights, to bars, and to the jazz clubs Roy loved. After a month of this, Roy ceased to appear. Ringing his doorbell and confronting him turned out to be useless. Weeks would go by until they bumped into each other again and were on. This kept up for a year. Elizabeth was in love with Roy, and this on-again, off-again business upset her. She discussed it with Holly Lucas. "I can't bear it," Elizabeth wailed. "Why does he do this to me?" "I would tell you," Holly said, "but you don't want to know."
"Yes, I do."
Holly, who was a great fan of Roy's, explained. "For a smart girl, Elizabeth, you have a very selective intelligence. You like your mother. You like to see a situation in the light that does you the most good. You think Roy is afraid of intimacy, which is a stylish thing to say. But the truth is that Roy is a little too fond of you. And when it occurs to him that there's nothing in it, he pulls back for both your sakes."
"What do you mean, both our sakes?"
said Elizabeth, who was reaching for her handkerchief. "Roy is wonderful. Anyone with sense would love Roy. But Roy drinks too much. Roy dresses badly. Roy wants to be a solitary hero. Roy told you that his idea of happiness is to go off to an island in Lake Michigan with a transistor radio and a case of scotch. You will never marry Roy, and Roy will never marry you. Since you're both old-fashioned, that's bound to catch up with you."
"Yes," said Elizabeth, "it's true. And if I hang around with Roy, I don't have to marry anyone else."
Holly had told her this before. "Absolutely," said Holly. "If you married Roy, both of you would be miserable. Face the fact that you're having a love affair that isn't unhappy, but will not lead to anything." Elizabeth knew the truth when she heard it, but still she went to prize fights and to bars with Roy, intermittently. Meanwhile, once every 3 weeks or so, she had dinner with Nelson. So if her mother said, "Aren't you seeing any nice young men?" she could truthfully answer, "I see Nelson." Nelson called on a Wednesday to ask her out for Saturday. He always appeared in an elegant sports jacket and beautiful trousers.
It was hard for Elizabeth to admit that he was good-looking, but he was. One night, Nelson, who had been first in his class at law school, mentioned his volunteer prison work. "You go into prisons looking like that?" she asked. "Yes, and I wear my watch, too." Said watch was heavy and gold, a Rodker family relic. Oh, those cons must really love you. Well, as a matter of fact, they do, because they get the services of a first-rate lawyer for free. And why should I change what I wear to go into a prison? I'd feel very condescended to if someone did that to me. This prison reform business was hard on Elizabeth. None of Nelson's attitudes were wrong, and worse, he never bragged. How she wished that he had turned out to be a corporate lawyer, voting Republican, and talking about the creeping menace of socialism. Instead, he made a lot of money and did good works. There was nothing Elizabeth could pin on him. Nelson always took her to a good restaurant and always paid for the meal. But he explained, "I'm told you're living on what you earn, and since what I earn is about three times what you earn, it's silly for you to split the check. If you wanted to be fair, you'd invite me for dinner. Your mother told my mother you're quite a good cook." This was a sore subject with Elizabeth. She had invited her parents for dinner after concealing any incriminating thing in the house. Any trace of birth control was locked away. Any book her mother might pick up and say, "Darling, are you reading this?" was hidden from view. All but several bottles of liquor were placed under the sink. No bottles would mean that Elizabeth had no social life. Too many would mean that she was either drinking to excess or hanging around with those who did. Mrs. Leopold, who referred to these meals as Elizabeth's bohemian dinners, said to her daughter, "I don't know where you learn to use spices in such an original way," implying that Elizabeth never could have learned from her, and also that spices were common, and that real food eaten by real people was either plain American or French. So Elizabeth had no intention of being fair and inviting Nelson for dinner. She figured he was probably a spy. Still, these dinners with him were not unpleasant, but after the pleasantest of them, Elizabeth made sure that when Nelson left her at her door, she changed her clothes and went next door to Roy Howard. In early December, Roy Howard moved away. He promised he would stay in touch, but Elizabeth began to cry. Roy said, "I love you in my own way, but not in any way that will do you any good." Then he gave her a kiss. And she knew he would continue to turn up intermittently. However, his moving brought her very low. She saw Nelson rather more often. He took her for drives in the country, or for walks, or out for dinner. He talked to her about her work and his own. He was an excellent time filler. And Elizabeth began to think of him as an old friend, one of those friends who connects you to your past. During a drive one afternoon, he revealed to her that James was coming home for Christmas. Coincidental with the departure of Roy Howard was an onslaught by her mother, who appeared one day at Elizabeth's office to take her out to lunch. Soon, Elizabeth was picking at a salad in a ladies' tea room while her mother gently grilled her. Why did she look so unwell and tired? Was she having trouble sleeping? Should she make an appointment with Dr. Goldauer? Did her employers expect her to work herself into physical collapse? Mrs. Leopold had the knack of catching her daughter at her most vulnerable. "I'm perfectly fine. It's just been a hectic week at work," Elizabeth said coldly. Mrs. Leopold's eyes narrowed, a sign of war. War had once meant prohibition of riding lessons and telephone calls. Now, war meant a lecture, the only method left to Mrs. Leopold in her futile search for information. Basically, she wanted to know if Elizabeth was having romantic troubles, but since she would not ask,
She came down hard on the issue of family loyalty and Elizabeth's lack of interest in the needs of others. Elizabeth and Holly called these lectures a mother's 10 commandments, all of which they broke. Thou shalt tell thy mother everything. Thou shalt live very near thy mother. Thou shalt bring friends home for thy mother's approval. Thou shalt offer information about thy love life. Thou shalt dress according to thy mother's style. Thou shalt constantly be in debt to thy mother for sums large and small. Thou shalt have fierce family loyalty on all occasions. Thou shalt ask thy mother's opinion. Thou shalt confide thy troubles in thy mother so that thy mother may become hysterical. Thou shalt borrow thy mother's cleaning woman. The lunch was not a success, and Elizabeth and her mother parted in terrible tempers. 1 week later was the Rodkers' annual Christmas party, and Elizabeth was loaded for bear. Her first step was the purchase of a black velvet dress that was low in the back, low in the front, and sleeveless. Next was the gardenia she wore in her hair. She looked quite beautiful, but her mother could not approve of the dress, and she found the gardenia excessive. Nelson, however, found her ravishing and told her so. But Nelson's praise was not her goal. She was after James. She had decided that a little public bad behavior was exactly what she needed. It was time to get her mother off her back, outrage the Rodkers, and put to rest once and for all her imitation of a well-composed young woman. She could also blitz what she considered their tidy plans for her, a safe marriage to nice Nelson or someone very like him. As soon as she had knocked back several glasses of champagne, she felt up to putting her plan in operation. This was to flirt slowly and blatantly with James. Then, if he was as dashing as she imagined, she would seduce him and then make it known. Before he went back to England, she would dump him. She was about to edge herself over to him when she felt that warm hand on her forearm. Darling, Harriet says you haven't said hello to her. Harriet can go to hell, said Elizabeth, so fortified by Piper Heitzig that she ignored the threat of vengeance in her mother's eyes. She approached James Rodker. Next to him, the healthy Nelson palled. James looked haggard, tortured, just the sort of deep and troubled man you find in novels. Hello, she said with a big smile. I haven't seen you since I was a little girl. Well, 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 said James. Aren't you the grown-up? He turned her around and led her to a sofa. So, you're Nellie's little pal, he said. I've been hearing so much about you. I've always been hearing about you, Elizabeth said. Tell you what, said James. As soon as the whole crowd is here, let's you and me sneak out for a drink and talk about all we've been hearing. What say? All right, said Elizabeth, though this was not quite as she had planned. James had jumped the gun on her. But things worked out well enough. They made a public exit on the pretext of going out for a bag of ice and had the pleasure of watching Harriet Rodker's lips compress. But before she could speak, Elizabeth and James were out the door and into the elevator. He took her to a bar around the corner, a dull wood-paneled place, the sort of bar you can take your son to after a hockey game. They sat in a wooden booth and sipped their drinks in silence. James lit his pipe and smiled a knowing smile. So here you are, the little number they've tucked away for Brother Nelly, he said. I'm not tucked away for anyone. No, on second thought, you wouldn't be. Girls like you play for higher stakes. Love or income, or preferably both. I don't play for any stakes, Elizabeth said. How refreshingly young you are, said James. Mother implored me to be kind to you. As opposed to what? As opposed to dragging you by the hair, knocking you out and catching a social disease, or giving you one. Have you had many social diseases? Oh, several. I have contracted social diseases in Hong Kong, Saigon, and the town of High Wycombe. He set his dead pipe down on the table. Little girls like you, I beg your pardon. Women like you are meant to blush. Or don't you blush anymore? Probably not. Elizabeth realized that the romantic James was rather drunk. He then began a long discourse on the subject of the nuclear family, quoting extensively in French from a sociologist Elizabeth had never heard of. Then he launched into an explanation of the English economy, and Elizabeth realized that, for all that he was haggard, he was extremely dull. Suddenly, he stared directly into Elizabeth's eyes. "Have you got the keys to your apartment?" he said, and without waiting for an answer, continued, "Give them to me." Elizabeth was old enough to have been flirted with and propositioned many times. The men she liked best were straightforward, brave enough to state their intentions. The keys James Rodker wanted, he wanted to clean his pipe with, she was sure. The easy way with which he made his request indicated to her that this was a well-used ploy. If you forked over your keys, he cleaned his pipe. If you fluttered, James took this as a sign of encouragement and ended by using your keys to come and sleep with you. Elizabeth handed over the keys and watched James dig the ashes out of his pipe. "Clever girl," he said. "I think we ought to go back," said Elizabeth, who was beginning to feel sleepy. She was profoundly disappointed. James was not a man she wanted to flirt with, and she felt a cold coming on. "Not so fast," James said. "I'm going to tell you about all those things you heard about me." And he commenced to describe his college career, the flat he had inhabited in London, the girls he had lived with in Paris, the bar girls he had slept with in Saigon, his position on his paper, and the number of famous friends he had. Elizabeth had to suppress a yawn. "All right," said James, paying the bill, "back to the arms of the family. Don't you find it public-spirited of our lovely Nellie to work with the less fortunate?" Elizabeth swallowed. "Nelson's all right." "You, of course, are partisan," James said. "Nellie is an insect." When they returned to the party, Elizabeth realized that they had been gone for 2 hours, and the smug smile James wore announced that they had been up to no good. Elizabeth spent the next week in her apartment, wrapped in a quilt. The cold she had expected materialized. In addition to being ill, she was angry. From Holly, she had learned that James Rodker, during his stay, had not come home several nights and dropped her name frequently. Thus, it was assumed that she and James were up to further evil doings. She said to Holly, "I know I set out to seduce him, but he's just too awful. And besides, look at what he's done. He's set me up. He comes home to rub his parents' nose in it, and he used me." "Unthinkable," said Holly. On the afternoon of New Year's Eve, Elizabeth was curled up, dozing under her quilt. In a few hours, she would dress and go to the boozy, happy party Holly gave each New Year's. Elizabeth felt neither happy nor much in the mood for a party. She was brooding heavily, but she was interrupted by the doorbell. She started. It might be Roy Howard, who sometimes dropped by on a whim. But it was not. It was Nelson Rodker. "Hello," he said. "I was in the neighborhood, and I heard you were sick, so I decided to drop by and see you." This was most unlike Nelson. He was wearing a beautiful suit and gold cufflinks. The wind had blown his hair about and made his cheeks blaze. He looked healthy, but very serious. "I guess you came to find out if I was sleeping with your brother," Elizabeth said. "You're hardly the sort of girl to sleep with Jimmy. He's far too dull for you." "How would you know? I didn't come to fight with you or to check up on your behavior. You came as a kindly gesture to an ill friend. I came to see you because I wanted to. And to report back to our parents that I'm still alive and that James isn't hiding under my bed." "Elizabeth, what is wrong with you? I always think of you as a free spirit, and here you chain me to my family." "You are your family," Elizabeth said sulkily. "I am most certainly not my family. I don't like my family, and I never have. My family is silly, stuffy, and rigid. You're not the only one who behaved yourself and got out fast. What do you think I am?" "A model boy," said Elizabeth. Then Nelson did a most un-Nelson thing. He took the quilt from Elizabeth's shoulders, lifted her to her feet, and gave her the sort of kiss she had never associated with Nelson or anyone like him. "I came to tell you that I love you," said Nelson. "I've been wondering for months if I love you because I was told to when I was a child, or if I just love you. Well, I just love you." They stood very close for a long time, the quilt lying at their feet. "I don't know what to think," Elizabeth said. "I want to know if you hate me because you expect it of yourself or if you actually hate me." "I don't hate you," said Elizabeth. "Do you think you could love me?" Elizabeth discovered that her head was on his shoulder and that her arms were around his neck. "It seems to make perfect sense," she said, "but things don't happen this way, do they?" "Some old friends fall in love all of a sudden," Nelson said. "Whatever it is, I feel it. It seems to have hit me all at once, or maybe it's crept up on me without my knowing." "I'd like to take you to Holly's party," said Nelson. "That's not for hours." "Oh," said Nelson, "I'm sure we can find a way to pass the time. This will certainly amaze everyone," Elizabeth said. "Only if we tell them," said Nelson. "A secret romance is one thing, but a secret romance worth keeping a secret is quite another. Just the thing for us, don't you think?" They smiled ravishing smiles as they stood with their arms entwined. They agreed that it was just the perfect sort of thing for them.
That was An Old-Fashioned Story by Laurie Colwin, read by Maya Dillon. We'll be back in a minute with Joanna Gleason reading another love story, this one by Alice Hoffman. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts, recorded live at Symphony Space in New York City. Symphony Space's season is sponsored by Zabar's, offering the nation a taste of New York, coffee, gourmet foods, and gift baskets available online at zabars.com. We're showcasing love stories on this Valentine's season special. Here's Alice Hoffman's story, Examining the Evidence, read for us by Joanna Gleason.
The evening was clear, without storm clouds or thunder or any sign of rain. But when Margot Molinaro looked out her kitchen window, she noticed that a glowing object, the size of a billiard ball, was traveling along the metal fence in her backyard, moving more and more swiftly as it gathered momentum, throwing off sparks that flew out in every direction. Margot barely had time to move away from the window before the thing leapt into her house, uninvited, stinking like sulfur, and stopping the hands on the clock above the sink. The electromagnetic field inside the house went berserk. Wires popped within the walls, and every fuse blew. As Margot watched, shoeless and completely surprised, the ball of lightning moved about the room at only a few inches above the floor, slowly, almost thoughtfully, as though searching for something it couldn't seem to find. The lightning drew nearer and nearer to Margot's bare feet. She closed her eyes, expecting to be burned alive, but the glowing ball suddenly veered away, then picked up speed, and with a whoosh, it hit the refrigerator. The lightning collapsed in a sputtering gasp, like a pan of overcooked rice, falling onto the vinyl tiles where it left a gaping, blue-black mark, which sizzled like melted tar. This strange and luminous phenomenon, which was reported the following day in all the local papers, along with a photograph of Margot looking puzzled and pale, had done as much damage as a small contained hurricane. Margot had never been a good housekeeper, but now her place was such a disaster that she sat down and cried in the dark, a true necessity as the electricity was no longer working. When she'd pulled herself together and had washed her face with bottled water, the electromagnetic force had also rattled the pipes, allowing only rusty water to come out of the tap, Margot lit a candle and made a list of the things she now must do. Repaint over the singe marks on the kitchen walls, hire an electrician, find a plumber, figure out why things such as this only happened to her, when every other house on the block was perfectly fine and everyone else in the neighborhood had experienced nothing more unusual than dusky twilight and the call of the warblers who sang at the very same hour each day. The following morning, Margot went down to the hardware store and bought a gallon of yellow paint and a box of self-adhesive tiles for the kitchen, then headed over to scan the message board beside the door in search of a half-decent handyman whose services she could afford. Probably the best she could do was Johnny Ricketts, who was well-known in the neighborhood for his shoddy welding and even worse wiring, but as she took Johnny's card from the board, the owner of the hardware store approached. Like everyone else in town, Mike Sutton had heard about the ball of lightning and he was eager to see its effects. He took Johnny's card from Margot's hand and ripped it in two. "Don't hire that crook," he told her. "Hire me." Mike showed up the following morning at 7 while Margot was out in the backyard boiling water for coffee on the barbecue, since the electric stove was on the blink. When Mike saw the devastation in her house, he was truly impressed. He accepted the cup of Sanka Margot offered and then went to examine the black marks on the wall. "These were some abnormally powerful electrical currents. I'll bet your radio doesn't work." "Nothing works," Margot said. "Take a look at this." She picked up a corner of the throw rug she'd borrowed from her cousin Franny to reveal the tar-like consistency of the vinyl tiles. Mike knelt to study the floor. Must have been a geomagnetic storm. Although he had inherited the hardware business from his father, Mike was much more interested in science, and most especially in the stars. People in town would see him on the roof of the store on summer nights, so intent on his telescope, he didn't notice when anyone waved or called out his name. Margot spent the next few days painting and tearing up her old kitchen floor. By then, Mike had completed the rewiring and fixed the sink. He assured Margot the mess was far easier to repair than it had looked to be, and he'd send her a bill in the mail. He must have fiddled with the radio and the refrigerator as well because they were operating perfectly now, as was the stove. All the rest of that week, Margot cursed her fate as she put down her new kitchen floor. Her cousin Franny often came over in the afternoons,
to keep Margot company. She'd pull off the paper backing on the tiles and carefully hand them over to Margot, even though she should have been home in bed. Franny had had the worst luck in the world, and although Margot had had the second worst luck, it was difficult to complain in Franny's presence. "So how much did all of this cost you?" Franny asked. For in fact, when the floor was finished, the kitchen looked far better than it had before lightning struck. "I don't know exactly. I haven't gotten the bill yet." Margot poured them both iced tea. She didn't say a word when Franny took out a cigarette. They both knew that Franny's prognosis was terminal. Certainly, after all she'd been through, she had the right to enjoy the time she had left. Franny breathed out smoke and thought this over. Mike Sutton did all this work, and he didn't send a bill? Unless Margot was mistaken, her cousin was actually smiling. "Don't worry, he'll send one." But before he could, Margot had to call him back. This time, she awoke on an ordinary Tuesday to find that her yard was covered with an odd gossamer netting. When she opened her back door, she saw that the wispy stuff was made out of thousands of webs, each a parachute of sorts for a small brown spider. Mike came over that afternoon. He sprayed the lawn and all the shrubbery with a power hose to wash the webs away, but he insisted the spiders were harmless. "An unusual infestation," he admitted. "Just be thankful it wasn't Japanese beetles." Margot stood on her back porch to watch Mike collect the last of the webbing which was drifting from the low branches of a willow tree. She had chills up and down her legs, even though the weather was fine. When Mike started loading up his truck, she followed him out onto the street. "Has this happened to anyone else?" she asked. "No, not in this neighborhood. But think of it this way, you probably won't have any mosquitoes this summer." "Did you get your bill yet?" Franny asked the following week. Margot was working in the garden and Franny was lying on the chaise, covered by a wool blanket, even though the day was unusually warm. Franny wore a hat and gloves and shivered whenever a cloud drifted over the sun. "Don't worry, I'll get charged," Margot assured her cousin. Margot had on a sleeveless white shirt and a pair of old shorts. Her hands and legs were patchy with dirt. She was still pretty, even without her makeup. But what good would that do her? She used to care about her appearance. She used to be wild with hope. But now she worried too much. So far, she had found close to a dozen brown spiders in her perennial bed, and the soil felt odd to the touch. She dusted herself off and came to sit on the edge of the chaise, placing Franny's feet in her lap. Maybe there's a blight on this house. Maybe it was built over an ancient graveyard. It was built over a potato farm, Franny reminded her. "I don't know," Margot sighed. "Things come in threes." "You had lightning and insects. What comes next?" They looked at each other and considered. "Floods," they agreed. To see if there was any way to work against her fate, Margot went down to the basement and turned off the water pressure. She emptied the bins of ice in her freezer and called to cancel her usual delivery of spring water. All the same, she awoke one night with a strange feeling in the pit of her stomach. There was a clatter above her, as if stones were being thrown at her windows and walls. Her heart began to race as though she were under attack. It was a warm spring night and the crickets were calling. Margot peered out her bedroom window. The neighborhood was peaceful and dark, but her own lawn and walkway seemed oddly shiny and bright. When she looked more closely, she saw that her property was covered with hailstones the size of eggs. The hail had torn through her roof and collected in piles in the attic. By morning, the melting hail had leaked through the ceilings, leaving inches of water on the floor. Mike arrived while Margot was mopping up the living room. She had preserved one hailstone in the freezer, carefully packaging it in plastic wrap so no one would dare call her a liar. The hailstone weighed 4 ounces and had a dark blue center. Mike looked it over thoughtfully, and while he did, Margot took a step backward. She had a rattling feeling in her chest, almost as if the hailstones were still falling. "There must have been an atmospheric disturbance right above your house," Mike Sutton said, "a small, distinct field of concentration." When he went up to patch the roof, Margot fetched the pot of split pea soup she had made earlier and walked around the corner to Franny's. Margot had brought over dinner for the past few nights, and now her cousin Gretel met her at the side door. "I don't know why you do this," Gretel said. "She's not eating anymore." Gretel had spent the past year caring for her mother, but now a nurse had been hired to assist her in the evenings. Still, Gretel only left her mother to go outside and smoke a cigarette or to cry. She didn't care about lightning or hail, and she cared even less about soup, but Margot kissed her anyway and took the soup inside. She ladled out a bowl for herself and one for Franny and then brought a tray into the darkened bedroom. "It's okay," she told the nurse, who had risen from the rocking chair to help out. "I can manage. Why don't you get yourself some dinner?" No one but the nurse would ever eat the split pea soup, but that didn't matter. Sometimes things happened for which there was no rational explanation, and the best anyone could do was record and remember. "Did you have the flood?" Franny asked when Margot came to lie down beside her in bed. Margot crawled under the covers and took Franny's hand. "It was hail. It came through the roof, then melted." Franny laughed. "That was tricky." Her laughter was sweet and thin, like the blade of grass found in the backyard. "That was a good one." "So what do you think?" Margot said. She was crying, but she tilted her head so that Franny wouldn't see. "You know what I think," Franny said. "It all adds up." They held hands until Franny fell asleep. By the time Margot walked home, the sky was already darkening. Dusk fell onto the asphalt like a curtain or a dream, then spread over hedges and lawns. All the same, as soon as Margot turned the corner, she could see Mike up on her roof, and try as she might, she couldn't think of a single reason not to run home.
Joanna Gleason read Alice Hoffman's Examining the Evidence. We hope you enjoyed these love stories. Selected short CD, Falling in Love, has romance in the air, tempting the imagination, stirring tales of love, longing, and desire. You can purchase this by going to our website, selectedshorts.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2007 by Stephen King, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is given by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund in the New York Community Trust, the Henry Nias Foundation, the Axe Houghton Foundation, the Arthur Foundation, and members of the Symphony Space Literature Producers Circle. Public funds come from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art, and the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.